We resume our deliberations this evening. We find ourselves in Parshas Shoftim. Quite a bit to say, as we will see. You have to know if you give the rabbi a three-week break, the shear upon return, there'll be a few things to say. So Shoftim, of course, begins with Shoftim. There's many mitzvahs in Parshas Shoftim, but it begins with matters that pertain to the Shoftim themselves. The Sanhedrin, the way to appoint a Sanhedrin, and also what the Sanhedrin is for. And Psukim that I'd like to begin with in Perek Yud Zayin, Pasuk Ches and Tes. Well-known Psukim, I believe, and perhaps one or two new insights as we are Ma'ayin in the Psukim. So Pasuk Ches reads of Perek Yud Zayin, Ki pale mimcha davar la'mishpat. If there is a matter, you, regionally, wherever you are, that is too difficult for you, it eludes you in matters of mishpat, bein dam ledan, bein din ledin, bein negar negar, different areas of halacha, matters relating to blood or judgment or afflictions, divrei rivos b'sharecha, matters that are disputed in your locale, so you seek arbitration. You're looking for an authoritative psak, so you come to the highest authority, which is the central Sanhedrin. V'kamtova alisa, you rise up and you come. El hamokam asheivchar Hashem elokecha bo, to the place that Hashem chooses, which is, of course, the Beis HaMikdash. As we know, the Torah insists that the highest Sanhedrin sit in session adjacent to the premises of the Beis HaMikdash itself. The Beis HaMikdash is the center not only for Avoda, which we know that it is, Korbanos and the like, but also it is ultimately the center of Torah, Ki Mitzion Tetze Torah. Uvasa el HaKohanim HaLevim, you come to the Kohanim Levim, who typically were judges, Ve'el HaShofet, or otherwise the judge, Asher Yebayimim Ahim, who will be at that time, you shall seek out their counsel, and they will tell you whatever the mishpat is, and that's what you need to follow. Now, as we can appreciate, there's much to take note of in these psukim, but one phrase specifically that I'd like to focus on is the phrase in Pasuk Tes, which says, "Velashofet, the judge, asher yihyeh bayamim ha'heim, who will be at that time." As we can appreciate, that appears to be somewhat redundant. You could not seek out any other judge. The judge at the time is the judge who's there. What then is the emphasis here, or the message of these words, Asher Yeh Bayamim Hahem? Rashi comments from Chazal, and Rashi says almost a statement of recognition. Afilu Eino Kishar Shoftim Shahayu Lefanav. Even if he's not of the same stature of the Shoftim of previous generations, or perhaps even the generation just gone by, can often happen. Perhaps those that are approaching the Shofet or the Sanhedrin for judgment, they may be older than him, or they may remember the generation before, two generations before. We're often hit by nostalgia at times like this, where we remember the Alta Doros, when the Shoftim were Shoftim. We always have a very high appraisal of people that aren't here anymore. But the point is, at the expense of those who are. And therefore the Pasuk emphasizes, if these are the Shoftim that you have, these are the Shoftim that are for you. And the authority goes from generation to generation. All you have is the judge before you. You'll always be conscious of the one who's not there, but that is not a correct path at all. And therefore, according to Rashi, to summarize, the point of these words, Asher Yiyeh Bayamim Haheim, means even if they are not as in previous generations, that's what you have now, and that's what you work with, and that's what the Torah is directing you towards. But there is another nuance within this phrase, Asher Yeh Bayamim Haheim, which is drawn out based on the approach of the Rambam to these psukim. Interestingly, as we will see, not only will we find the Rambam's halachic approach here, but we will also see the Rambam's parshanut approach, which doesn't always happen. Most of Mishnah Torah, the Rambam, he tells you the halacha, he may give you a bit of the background, but in our instance, as we'll see, he mamish goes through the psukim, which is quite an event. We begin, of course, by the important position of Rambam, which is a big discussion in itself. The two psukim, or more, Pasuk Yud and Pasuk Yud Aleph, contain a positive and negative commandment, respectively. Pasuk Yud says, "Va'asisa al pi hadavar asher yagidu lecha." You must act in accordance with whatever it is that they, the Sanhedrin, say. That's a positive mitzvah. Pasuk Yud Aleph, in the middle, states, "Lo sosur, do not swerve min hadavar, from whatever they say, asher yagidu lecha, yamin u'smol," with the famous discussion of what does it mean, right and left, which we spoke about on previous occasions. But the point is, Pasuk Yud and Yud Aleph contain Torah commandments, one positive, one negative, pertaining to the Sanhedrin, which is very interesting, because that means that the Torah underwrites, so to speak, the judgment of the Sanhedrin. They're covered by Torah mitzvahs, ultimately. But the critical question is, what is it that the Sanhedrin says that is covered by this mitzvah? Anything that they say? Sanhedrin can say many things, many different types of things. And this is where the Rambam comes in. The Rambam will preface Baal Peh, and then we'll read one or two lines from Rambam inside. The Rambam, as is his way, codifies and categorizes the different areas that the Sanhedrin will issue rulings about into three domains. They are, number one, interpretation of psukim through the methodology of Medrash Halacha, what we call darshaning the psukim. That's one domain, darshaning psukim, which relates to Torah mitzvahs. Number two, they have traditions, which are not based in psukim, what's called Halacha L'Moshe Mi-Sinai, pure oral Torah. These are things that they hold and transmit from generation to generation. That's number two. And number three are the laws and enactments of the Rabbanon themselves. So we're familiar with some of their mitzvahs, Chanukah and Purim and Shabbos candles and so on and so forth, as well as their restrictions, muktzah and all the protective measures of the Rabbanon. That's the third domain. The question is, how many of these domains are covered by the Torah's injunction of following them and the prohibition not to depart from them? And here, Rambam famously, in the beginning of Hilchos Mamrim, Perek Aleph, Halacha Beis, states, Echad devarim shelamdu osam mipi hashmua, whether it's things that they've received as traditions, Veim Torah shebal peh, that is pure oral law, that's category number one. Ve'echad, and also devarim shelamdu mipi datam ba'achas min hamidos shatorah nidreshes bahen, in matters of expounding the halacha through the principles of Medrash Halacha. That's number two, darshaning psukim. And number three, ve'echad dvarim she'asum siyag le'Torah, and also their own enactments, protective fences for the Torah, lefi mashashat sricha, whatever is needed, gezeros, takonos, etc., kol echad ve'echad me'elu hashlosha dvarim. Each and every one of these three areas, mitzvah sase lishmo alahen, there is a Torah mitzvah to follow them, v'ha over al kol echad mehem over below ta'ase. And one who violates any of those things violates a lo ta'ase. So that's a very important statement of Rambam, because essentially what we call dinim derabbanon, they are the Rabbanon in inception, that is to say, they're propounded by the Rabbanon. But in terms of their authority, they're underwritten by this mitzvah of lo sosur. Now, what does this have to do with our pasuk? Or how do we get it from the pasuk? The Rambam gives us a window here and says as follows. Harehu omer. Behold, the pasuk says, and he quotes our two psukim. Let's watch carefully how he aligns and matches up the different phrases in our psukim to these different categories. It says, Al pi haTorah asher yerucha, which is the beginning of Pasuk Aleph, Yud Aleph, based on the Torah asher yerucha. So the Torah, would they instruct you, says Rambam, Eilu atakonos vagezeros vahaminhagos. That refers to their enactments. HaTorah asher yerucha is the area of rabbinic enactment. Okay. Next, Vala mishpat asher yomru. What about mishpat? Eilu dvarim shalom du osam mipi hadin, min hadin. These are halachas that they expounded through darshaning the halacha. And then the final expression, that refers to their oral traditions. And therefore, to summarize, the Rambam looks at Pasuk Yud Aleph. We have three, essentially the Torah seems to be saying the same thing in three different ways, but it's actually referring to three different categories. Torah Asher Yerucha, Mishpat Asher Yomer Lecha, and Dovar Asher Yagidu Lecha. All those three phrases refer to three areas of what the Sanhedrin, how they operate. And they're all covered by the Torah's mitzvah to heed the Sanhedrin. Now, there is a further point. It's a delicate matter. I do not know if it's that well known. But again, it's explicit in the Rambam there in Perek Beis of Hilchos Mamrim. And that is, says Rambam, of these three categories, with regards to the middle category, that is to say, darshaning halacha, expounding the psukim through applying the principles of Medrash Halacha, says Rambam, that can be subject to the judgment of each generation of Sanhedrin, regardless of what was said before. That's a chiddush. As if to say, if an earlier generation has darshaned the pasuk in a certain way, yielding or deriving a certain halacha, de'oraisa, from that pasuk, a later Sanhedrin can come and darshan that same pasuk in a different way, deriving a different halacha, perhaps in conflict with the earlier halacha. In that respect, that the authority of each generation of Sanhedrin can darshan the psukim the way that they see as correct. Now, to appreciate in relief, this is said with regards to this area of halacha, darshaning psukim. It is specifically not said with regards to either of the other two. Of course, there's no way that they can contest a tradition back from Moshe from Sinai. They have nothing to say. Well, they are bearers of that tradition. But also the third category of rabbinic enactments are not to be annulled. Or there are the famous stipulations. They need to be wiser and greater, which rarely, if ever, will happen. So of these three categories, the middle category stands out. Drushes of psukim depend on the Sanhedrin in that generation, regardless of what was said in earlier generations. That's a chiddush. Of course, the Rambam has his sources. Interestingly, Reb Velvel Soloveitchik of Brisk explained in this light a very interesting exchange that took place in the end of Megillas Rus. We have in Perek Dalet of Megillas Rus, the time comes for Rus to get married. Someone's going to marry her, what's called to redeem her, and he'll be the one that will get the whole estate, really, of Machlon back on its feet. And Boaz, as we know, married her in the end, but he was not the first in line, and there was a certain priority to be given to a closer relative, who is known with the unforgettable name of Plony Almoni. So that's his fame. And he's called the Goel. He was the first one. And he refused. And why did he refuse? These are his words. This is in Rus Perik Dalad, Pasuk Vav. Vayoma HaGoel, lo uchal lig'oli. I'm very sorry, but I cannot do this. I cannot step in, marry Rus, and with all that goes with that. Why not? Pen ashchis es nachalosi. Because perhaps I will thereby ruin or destroy my inheritance. You do it, he says to Boaz. Ga'al l'cha atas gulasi. I can't do it. Lo uchal l'gol. Now the question is, what is he exactly afraid of? And what does he mean when he says, pen ashchis es nachalosi? I don't want to marry her. Maybe I'll ruin my nachala. What does that mean? You're going to get nachala. Rashi explains, Nachalasi Zar'i, those that will inherit from me. I might ruin things for them. As the Pasuk says in Tehillim, Hinei Nachalas Hashem Bonim. Nachala refers to children. I don't want to ruin things for my children. How are you going to ruin things for your children? Because the pasuk says, "Shenemar leyavo amoni u'moavi," because she's from Moab, and the Torah says you can't marry someone from Moab. And so if I do, and I have children from her, and then no one's going to marry them because you can't do that. So you do it. Very interesting situation here. But the question, of course, is, now he didn't know, as Rashi concludes, he didn't know that the restriction applies only to the males, not to the females. As we say, Moavi velo Moavis. He didn't know the risk was okay. He thought she wasn't okay. So he didn't want to do it. Now the very simple question is, if he really thinks that there's a problem, he doesn't realize that it's mutter to marry Rus, he thinks it's usur, so why does he express his reservations in terms that no one will marry his children because he did something wrong? If he thinks it's wrong, that's the reason why he doesn't want to do it, because he doesn't want to do something wrong. If he feels that she's forbidden to him, that's the reason not to marry her, not because it could cause problems for the next generation. It's a problem now. So why does he only express the perceived problem or his anticipated problem in terms of what may happen to his children? That's a good shaila. Well, Reb Velvel takes us to a very interesting exchange that took place at the time when David killed Goliath. Now we get, of course, very swept up with the fight itself, but we should not forget that Shaul had promised his daughter in marriage to whoever kills Goliath, which means that order number one of the day was killing Goliath. Order number two was Shiduchim, as if to say, he's the one that killed Goliath, so now we need to start looking into him. He's already had the first date in the sense that he's killed Goliath, but okay. So and that's why Shaul says, "Bishal mi ben mi hanarazer," who is he? But the Gemara, this is all in Yevamos and Daf Ayin Vav, the Gemara says, you don't know who he is? Shaul knows David very well. David has already been playing the harp before Shaul. He knows him. So what is he asking? Where is he from? Because now he really needs to do a background check. He needs to check his pedigree. Is he eligible to marry into royalty? That's the question. Now, present there at the battlefield was a very difficult person. He himself has much to say about him. His name was Doeg HaDomi. He was an outstanding Torah scholar, but personality-wise and character-wise, a great deal left to be desired. And Doeg pipes in at this stage. And Doeg says, why are we discussing the more luxury question of whether he can marry into royalty? I'm not sure he can marry anyone who's Jewish. You know where he comes from. He comes from Moab. Can't marry into Moab. So he sought to basically shut out David from being able to marry anyone. And he's a serious Torah personality. And there began a debate. Who else is there? Avner is there. Avner ben Ner. And Avner says, the pasuk says, Le'avo Moavi. And therefore, surely Moavi means specifically the males and not the females, so he should be okay. The Moab roots of David are from Rus, and she's a female, and therefore it's okay. It's all okay. But Doeg wasn't having it, and Doeg says, no, just because the Torah uses the Loshon Zohar, the male form, it doesn't mean to exclude the females. The Torah bars other people. The Torah bars the mamzer from marrying to the Jewish people. Will we say that only applies to a male, not a female? Not at all. So Avner keeps going, yeah, but the Torah gives the reason why they can't marry into the Jewish people. They didn't come out to give you lechem v'yayim when you came out from Mitzrayim. That's the sort of thing that only men do, not so much women, therefore they're not really part of the problem. Doeg is not moved. Doeg says, no, not at all. That the men should have gone out for the men, the women for the women. It's 100% in force for both. And it was reached a gridlock here. And no one knew what to do until Amasa ben Yeser. So he went to the Sanhedrin quick as he could, came back, and he brought back, he says, Kach mekublani mi beis dino shel Shmuel haramasi. I have a Kabbalah from the Beis Din of Shmuel that when it says Amoni, it means only the males and not the females. Velo Amonis. When it says Moavi, it means the males and not the females. And that is the end of the story. So what is the measure of this exchange? They're going back and forth until Amasa comes, and he heard from the Beis Din, and then the matter is settled. But what was before, and what was afterwards? So Rebbe Velvel says, initially, I mean, people were not so familiar with this tradition, and therefore the understanding was, it's a drasha. And it's a legitimate drasha, unless you darshan differently. Doeg was the head of the Sanhedrin, and therefore what he is saying is that if that's how they darshaned, I can darshan like this. And when it comes to drushas, it goes according to the head of the Sanhedrin, or the Sanhedrin generally, in each generation. But if they see things his way, he can sway the drusha differently. And that's why it looked like, in terms of as drusha per se, the David would be shut out. Everything changed when Amasa came back and said, Kach mikublani, as if to say, this dispensation or this permission for the females from Moab and the females from Ammon, it's not from a drasha that could perhaps be darshan differently by the head of the Sanhedrin in a certain generation. It's a Kabbalah. It's a tradition. As Rambam says in Hichus and elsewhere in Mishnah Torah, Halacha l'Moshe miSinai. Doeg has no jurisdiction over such a tradition, and therefore at that stage he had to fold. So we see this idea in action. As long as they thought it was a drasha, perhaps there's room to maneuver if you're the head of the Sanhedrin. As soon as it's a Kabbalah, pure tradition from Moshe miSinai, there's no room to maneuver, there's no room for any input or alteration at any stage or counter viewpoints. Interestingly, and then perhaps one may say typically, the Vilna Gaon explains that this is what David HaMelech refers to in Tehillim. One of the chapters of Tehillim, Kuf Yud Tes, which is the longest, 176 psukim, 8 psukim for each letter of the Aleph Beis. So in the letter Shin or Sin, so there's 2 psukim which read as follows. The first pasuk says, Sarim Ridafuni Chinam. Sarim, nobles, were pursuing me, chinam, for no good reason. Umidvarcha pachad libi. And I was fearful from your word. That's the first pasuk. Sarim ridafuni chinam, umidvarcha pachad libi. The next pasuk, well-known pasuk, sasanochi alem rosecha, kamotse shalarav. I delight, exult over your saying as someone who finds a great treasure. So it's interesting, says the Vilna Gaon, we need to find the context, which we will in just a moment, but Pasuk 1 says that David is fearful from Hashem's word, midvar ha-pachad libi. The next Pasuk says that he delights over Hashem's saying, sasanochi elim rasecha. So are Hashem's words cause for fear for David, or for delight? Says the Gaon. The difference between the idea of dibur versus amira is that Dibur pertains to the area of Torah Shebichtav, Hashem's word, the word that he dictated to Moshe, and Amira, the saying, refers to Torah Shebaal Peh, to the oral law. And this actually has a basis in Rabbeinu Bachi and Parshas Bo, Vayidaber Hashem and Moshe Leimor, means Hashem dictated the following words of Chumash to Moshe Leimor, right, with the then injunction of expounding upon it. Daber Abnei Yisrael, Va'amarta Lehem. Tell them the words and expound on them. Torah Shebichtav, Torah Shebaal Peh. Says the Vilna Gaon, the first pasuk, Sarim Ridafuni Chinam, the nobles, they were pursuing me. Who's pursuing him? Which nobles are pursuing? Doeg and his cohorts. They're the nobles, the head of the Sanhedrin, respectable people, noble people. And they're pursuing me to bar me from entering into the Jewish people, from marrying into the Jewish people. And moreover, umidvarcha pachad libi, and based on your word, that is to say, the relevant psukim, I actually was afraid, because you could argue that there's no room for leniency based on the reading the written word. That's the situation as it was in terms of Torah Shebichtav. He then goes on to say, sasanochi al imrasecha, where did my joy come from? Where did my delight come from? Imrasecha, the oral word. Torah Shebaal Peh, because Torah Shebaal Peh says that when it bars the Ammon and Moab, it is only the males and not the females. That's the treasure for David, because that was his entry into marrying to the Jewish people. So that's a classic comment of the Vilna Gaon in his, as he says often, everything that's to be found in the Gemara can be traced back in some way to the psukim themselves. In any event, says Rav Velvel Soloveitchik, now we can understand, perhaps on a deeper level, the exchange between this Goel, this Ploni Almoni, and Boaz. The Goel, he was reluctant to marry Rus because of his children. Except the question is, well, if you think there's something wrong with it, then it should be a problem for you, not just for your children. But the point is, says Rav Velvel, that this Goel, he was aware that there was this idea around that it's the males and not the females, Moavi, velo Moavis. But he thought it was a drasha. In other words, he thought this was the exposition of the Sanhedrin. Well, they can do that. But if it's a drasha, it can be undone by a later generation. And therefore he's saying, look, you're Boaz, you're the head of the Sanhedrin. If you say that's what it means, I don't have a problem with it. But who's to say that the next set of the Sanhedrin, or a number of generations down the line, may look at the psukim differently, as Doeg himself was inclined to do? And therefore, for my future generations, for their sake, I don't want to get involved in something that could then rebound or resurface at a subsequent point. His point of mistake, and interestingly that Boaz did not really see fit to correct him on, was that this, as we saw from Shmuel Haramasi, that this law of Armoni, Velo Armonis, etc., is not a drasha. It's a Kabbalah. It's not subject to change. That was the lack of information that he had. And Boaz did not correct him. But of course, there is no reversal of this leniency if it's in the category of pure Torah Shebaal Peh. So that's a bit of an excursion into the Rambam. What does it have to do with our psukim? Says the Shiras David, Rav Aaron David Goldberg of Tells, just to see how people learn Chumash in this way. I'm not sure that we can do this with every pasuk because we need to get home to eat at some stage, but just to behold it is something special. Go back to Pasuk Tess. Pasuk Tess told us, Uvasah Elakoanim Alviyim, Pasuk Tes refers to the area of inquiry known as Mishpat. And by the way, so does Pasuk Ches. Ki pale mimcha davar la Mishpat. Now, as Rambam himself told us, of the three areas, Torah, Mishpat, Davar, of those three, Mishpat is the one that refers to the drushes of the psukim. That's Mishpat. Ah, says the Shiras David, if the area of Torah called Mishpat refers to the way the Sanhedrin dashes the psukim, then perhaps we can have a deeper insight as to why the pasuk then says, Asher yiyeh bayamim haheim, go to the judge who will be in that generation. Seemingly redundant words. Rashi gave his interpretation, but according to the Rambam, it could be the reason why the Torah emphasizes Asher yiyeh bayamim haheim is because in this area of the three, specifically, drushes of psukim, it follows the shofet in that generation. Whether it is the same as generations before or not. And therefore, the position of Rambam that drushes can be reappraised in subsequent generations seemingly is based in the pasuk itself when it comes to mishpat asher yeh bayamim ahim. So that's his offering, that's his explanation with regards to that phrase and those psukim. Well, I'd like to take a look further in the parsha, moving on from the beginning, to have a look at a fascinating idea that comes out from the beginning of Perek Kaf. Perek Kaf, Pasuk Aleph. And again, we'll be working with the parshanut here. What does the pasuk say? Ki tzei lemelchama alevecha, when you go out to war against your enemies, v'ra'isa sus berecha v'amrav mimcha, if you see horses, chariots, people that are more numerous than you, lo sir mehem, do not fear them, Hashem is with you, and you'll be okay. Now, there's many different ways to approach this pasuk, but the specific area that I wish to discuss for a few moments, I would preface by saying the following. There is a concept, and it is to be found in a number of mefarshim, which states the following. Sometimes the Torah describes someone or some people in the Torah as seeing something. He saw the following. They saw such and such. Okay. The point that these mefarshim explain is that when the Torah uses that expression, he saw the following, or they saw the following, what it then describes is the situation as that person saw it, or as those people saw it, as if to say, it's almost as if a virtual caption has been opened up. When the Torah uses the word, he saw, you are now looking through the lens of the person who is seeing. Now it is not necessarily the case that what he saw was what the Torah, how the Torah would describe it, or perhaps even the reality. But at this stage, the Torah is describing him seeing, so it tells you what he saw as he saw it. That's a very interesting idea. In a sense, one could say it's an extension of the idea that when the Torah quotes a person who's speaking, so it quotes what he said. It doesn't quote what the Torah would say. Sometimes the Torah doesn't even agree with him, but you have to know. Paro said, I'm not sending the Jewish people out. That's not true. Yes, you are. You think you're not. Okay, when Paro's talking, we hear what Paro thinks. We hear what Paro wants. It's not necessarily what the Torah wants. And so on and so forth. And therefore, in the same way that when the Torah quotes a person, it quotes their words, because the Torah wants us to know their words, so too, when the Torah says that someone saw something, it wants us to know how the person saw it. That's also part of what the Torah wants us to know. A couple of examples, and then we'll get to back to our pasuk. But it really is, there's much to ponder here, and one can really go through Chumash in this way, aware of this idea. In the beginning of Parshas Vayeshev, Yosef and the brothers, the pasuk states that the Yisrael ha'aves Yaakov mikol banav, Yaakov loved Yosef more than his other sons, etc. and so forth. Now the brothers did not take kindly to this, as we know. And the next pasuk says, "Vayiru the brother saw ki oso ahav avihem mikol echav," that he loved Yosef more than the other brothers. Now, there's a very delicate point here because it is not just restating what the first pasuk said. First pasuk said that he loved Yosef more than anyone else. Second pasuk says they saw that he loved Yosef more than anyone else. It doesn't say it in the same way, though. There's a shift in nuance. The first pasuk says that he loved Yosef more than all his sons. The second pasuk says they saw that he loved Yosef more than all his brothers, all of Yosef's brothers. But what is the difference between them? Rav Chanoch Ehrentroy, the Zatzal, the Rav of Munich, in a couple of generations back, the grandfather of Shibbol L'Chaim, Rav Ehrentroy of London, he explains, and the Malbim says similarly, that there's two different ways to understand the special bond that existed between Yaakov and Yosef. On an emotional level, it often happens that a father is more attached to one of the sons than perhaps the others. That can be, maybe it shouldn't be, but it can be. That's not so much an appraisal of the worth of that son. It's specifically a reflection of a special connection that exists between them. And that's how it is. He's the Ben Zikunim, etc. and so forth. The pasuk says, Yaakov loved Yosef mikol banav. Out of all his sons, in terms of father-son relationship, he had developed a closer relationship with Yosef than with the others. Okay, even that, the Gemara says that he should have treated them the same. It's a well-known statement of the Gemara. But with the brothers, not only did they see this, they actually saw something else. What they saw was that Yaakov loved Yosef more than all his brothers. What is the difference between saying more than all his sons or more than all his brothers? More than all his sons is a personal father-son thing. More than all his brothers, that's a judgment statement, as if to say, as a brother from among his peers, he saw that Yosef was more worthy than the others. That's how they interpreted it. But they felt that was Yosef's doing, perhaps to put them down, etc. and so forth. That's what led to the reaction as it was. What do we see from here? It's a subtle thing. But what we see is the Torah first gives you the situation as it was, but then will follow up with the situation as it was perceived. Yaakov had a certain relationship. The brothers didn't see it that way. Maybe Yaakov should have alerted them to the fact, or etc. and so forth, however one understands that parsha. What we do see is what the person sees and what the Torah describes are not always the same at all. Similarly, in fact, it goes back a little further. The Maharal discusses the well-known question as to who it was that bought Yosef, who sold Yosef. There's a couple of different ways that these people are being described. One pasuk describes them as Ishmaelim. One pasuk describes them as Socharim, Midyanim. So who are they? And the Maharal says, the pasuk states, Vayisu es eneim. They raised up their eyes. Yosef's brothers raised up their eyes. Vihine orchas Ishmaelim. And behold, what is there? Orchas Ishmaelim. A caravan, a troop of Yishmael. What does that mean? Here, Vayiru, Vihine Orchas Yishmael, they saw. Here is a group of Yishmael. Says Maharal, when they saw approaching from a distance this group, they were not yet distinct. And generically, they looked, as far as the brothers are concerned, like a group of Yishmael. The reality is that they weren't. They were Midyanim. Okay. For what it's worth, when the Torah tells us Hinei Ochas Ishmaelim, it tells us what the brothers saw, because that's how they saw them, that's how they perceived them. They weren't so particular or whatever. When the Torah itself describes the event, it then calls them Midyanim. So to the extent that these are essentially not really the same categorization, we have both of them because you have the Torah's presentation of what happened, but then the Torah's presentation of the brothers' perception of what happened. And so it is in many situations. Very interesting idea. Achar hadvarim ha'eile, having discussed this idea and given it some type of background, let us now come back to our pasuk, and we will see that there is what to discuss here, specifically within Rashi. Again, the pasuk reads, Perek Kaf, Pasuk Aleph. Ki tetzel melchama alevecha. When you go out to war against your enemy, v'ra'isa sus v'rechev amravimcha, you see horses and chariots, more people, more numerous than you, lo sirma mehem, do not fear them. Let us follow now Rashi's comments very carefully in light of our background. On the pasuk aloivecha, on your enemy, Rashi says, Yehiyu be'einecha ke'oivim. You need to relate to them as enemies. If they're your enemies, you need to treat them as such. Al terachem aleihem. You cannot be compassionate with them. Ki lo yirachmu alecha. Because they're not going to have rachmanus on you. That's number one. Which means, aloivecha is stating the situation as it needs to be perceived. Okay. It's not just a statement of fact. It's almost a policy. You don't forget, because they won't forget. Next, sus v'rechev, horse and chariots. As Rashi comments, it's used in the singular. It sounds like there's only one. But one is not that bad. We understand it's a generic plural. But Rashi says be'inai chashuvim kulam kesus echad. In my eyes, that it's nothing. It's like however many there are. It's like one horse. It's like one chariot. It doesn't matter. That don't forget that. Next, on the phrase amrav mimcha, more than you, says Rashi, be'einecha hu rav. You may think that they're many and mighty. Ava be'einai eino rav. But as far as I'm concerned, they're not that many. They're not that strong. These are Rashi's comments. What is so interesting about these three short comments of Rashi? All of them are about perception. The first comment is about a perception that you should have, namely, remember, look at them as enemies, because that's what they are. Don't lose sight of that. The second represents Hashem's perspective, so to speak. It describes them in the singular because, as far as Hashem is, he looks at them as one of them. So the middle is Hashem's perspective. And then the third is our perspective, but it's an incorrect perspective, or it's not an absolute perspective. You think they're so mighty, but not really. That's not really true. So it's an amazing succession of how people see things. Number one, how you're meant to see things. Number two, how Hashem sees things. And number three, how you might see things contrary to the way Hashem sees things. So that itself is quite fascinating. But what is of particular interest to us, in light of our earlier discussion, is that of these three phrases, the only one which actually describes us seeing in the pasuk is the middle one. If we look at the pasuk, Vera'isa susverechev, you will see. Of all three phrases in the pasuk, that is the only phrase that has the verb seeing, us seeing, in the pasuk. But of all three, it is specifically the phrase that Rashi explains how Hashem sees. Vera'isa susverechev in the singular, because that's how I look at them. So actually, Rashi's comments are inverted, because whereas these other mefarshim that we discussed, their position is whenever the Torah talks about what you see, it presents it how you see it. Here, in these three phrases, it is the middle one that says what you see, but Rashi explains it how Hashem sees it. Which means clearly that Rashi does not subscribe to this idea that as soon as the Torah uses the expression of us seeing or a person seeing, it presents how the person sees it. Here, it used the term Vera'isa and specifically says how Hashem sees it. On the contrary, it is the first and third phrase that describe how we should see things or how we might see things. But they don't mention the term Vera'isa at all. They actually are a product of something else entirely. Redundancies. The pasuk says, "Ki teitzei lemelchama aleivecha." Why else would you go to war unless it's your enemy? So the word aleivecha is redundant, as if to emphasize, see to it, that you look upon him as such. So it's the redundancy that gives us the perspective from our part. And in the final phrase, "Am rav mimcha, mightier than you," Mimcha is what Rashi is commenting on. From your perspective, do you think that they're so mighty? Not from my perspective. So we see that the basis in the pasuk to discuss our perspective, it comes from redundancies. Aloivecha, mimcha. It comes from everywhere except the word Vera'isa. And this, I have to say, was quite a realization, revelation for me, because when I first saw the Rashi, I jumped at it and said, oh, you see, it's like your perspective, and is that like the others? Until you just look a little bit deeper, you look a bit closer, and you realize that Rashi is actually the opposite of that other approach for reasons that we have said. So once again, one can never look too closely at a Rashi. Okay. For a final discussion this evening, I wanted to take a look at the final mitzvah in the parsha, which is Egla Arufa, that famous process which happens, as the pasuk tells us, in Perek Kaf Aleph. It's these nine psukim of Perek Kaf Aleph. What's the background? Someone has been found. Terrible tragedy, he's in the field, he was killed, no one knows who did it, and as the pasuk describes, the Sanhedrin comes out, and then they measure to the closest city, and then that city brings an eglah, this calf, and then they decapitate it, and they ask for kapara. It's a rather unconventional mitzvah, if one could say. And what's it all about, if one may ask? The Rambam, in the Mirna Vuchim, in the third chelik, where he discusses Tameha Mitzvos. So in Perek Mem, he explains a very interesting comment on this whole process which happens. And that is, says Rambam, we do lots of things. It's a very public event. and the Sanhedrin comes out and they measure, it gets everyone's attention. And there's this whole thing with Egla Rufa. Why? Because, says Rambam, we want people to be talking about this. Why do you want to talk about it? Because there's a killer on the loose. And he's somewhere, or he was here recently, and maybe someone saw something, and if it's just if it's hushed up, or if it's just dealt with discreetly, so you could get away. But if everyone talks about it, you never know. Someone may say something. Oh, that thing, yes, I saw someone, and perhaps they pursue it. So the Rambam explains that the whole publicity which surrounds the Egla Rufa is in order to generate publicity. We want people to be talking about it, because you never know, it may trigger something that someone saw and may lead you to the killer. Very interesting. So according to the Rambam, if one may summarize, the process of Egla Rufa, it's with an eye on the future of catching up with the killer, not so much an eye on perhaps redressing the past, which maybe cannot be redressed. And that's where the Rambam says the members of the Sanhedrin come out. When the Sanhedrin visits an outlying area, there's talk about it. And the whole measuring from the city, which is the closest, etc. And moreover, there's a certain emotive, if one may say, emotive aspect to the Egla Rufa, which the Gemara discusses. Rashi quotes it, because we say that the Egla, specifically it's a young calf. And the Gemara says it's a young calf, which means it hasn't had children yet. It hasn't had offspring. It's going to die before it had offspring. And it goes into this harsh valley where nothing's ever grown, because the victim, so that's the end for him. And the Marsha explains, commenting on that Gemara in Sota, that this can all be explained, but really based on the Rambam's approach. That we're looking to shake people up a little bit. It's not just for a pure emotive effect. We want people to be impacted by it. We want people to be upset by it, to be shaken by it a little bit. Because maybe that will encourage them to do something about it and pursue it, if it can be pursued. And moreover, as the Abarbanel says, the animal is decapitated. Egla Arufa, it's killed from behind. It doesn't see the fact that it's going to be killed, just like this person. He left town unsuspecting that he was going to be a victim. All these things, they seem to be like symbolic in that way, but they're very evocative. And we want people to be impacted in that way. And moreover, says Abarbanel, we make a point of measuring to the closest city. We want that city to feel a certain pressure. No one probably likes the distinction of being the city that was measured to in the Egla Rufa situation. They're under a cloud a little bit. It's not okay for them. And we want them to be that, because they want them to perhaps again galvanize themselves and take the initiative to clear their name and find the person. So all of this is really based on the approach of the Rambam. But as is pointed out by the Ramban, so we haven't yet touched the heart of the Egla Rufa. It's about the publicity that's generated. But the mitzvah itself, the Rambam actually lists as one of the chukim. But certainly what we hope will come out of it, that's the publicity that the Rambam talks about. I'd like to mention, before we have a final general comment, there is a fascinating insight on Pasuk Tess, pardon me, Pasuk, the end of Pasuk Ches. They bring the Egla Rufa and they ask for Kapara. And the final phrase, if we take a look at Perek Kaf Aleph Pasuk Ches, the final phrase of the Pasuk says, V'nikaper lahem hadam. And if they do this, they'll be atoned. They'll be atoned for, the blood will be atoned for them. V'nikaper lahem hadam. Now, the word v'nikaper is very interesting, because it does not fit into any known category of word. When you think about it, we're familiar with some. There's the passive, what's called the nifal, the reflexive, the hispal, we know, however, the seven of them. V'nikaper is not a natural fit for any of them. Why? Because if it's a nifal, a passive, it should have been v'nikpar. V'nichbar, like nechdal and nilcham. It should have been nechdal, nichbar. The nikaper almost has the vowelization of a reflexive, but then it should have a taf. It should have been then viniskaper. So it's kind of like neither here nor there. It has the vowels of a reflexive of a hisbael, but it has the missing taf. So it has the letters of a passive. So which is it? Says the Ksava Kabbalah, quoting Rav Naftali Weisel. There is a concept where we're opening up a number of major concepts this evening. In Lashon HaKodesh, there is a concept of composite words, milim murkavot. The Torah uses words in order to get a message across. If there is a blended message, it will blend the grammatical constructs of those words. It's a fascinating idea. Now is not the time to go into examples, but there are many examples of this. We'll stick to the case at hand. You see, the question is, the Egla Rufa. They had this terrible tragedy, this person, no one knows who killed him. Then they do the Egla Rufa, and the Torah says, and it will atone for them, as if to say, that's it, nothing more needs to be done. Well, nothing more can be done, but the atonement is complete. But it depends. Because what if they subsequently find the killer? Imagine, they brought the Egla Rufa, and then they found the killer, and they say to the killer, okay, well, now you need to be dealt with. And the killer says, no, it's already been dealt with. You bought the Egla Rufa. Everyone's been atoned for, and we're all okay. Pending finding the killer, this brings them atonement. But if they do find the killer, this isn't enough. It's not the real thing. But it may have to suffice. You don't know yet. It depends. How is this reflected in the word v'nikaper? Because, says the Ksava Kabbalah, the passive form is a fact. It happens. Reflexive often denotes something which seems to happen but isn't real. Hasn't, right? It happens to itself, but it hasn't actually happened in reality. And that now is the question. Has there been an actual atonement or not? The answer is yes and no. It depends. If they don't find the killer, this will atone for them. But if they do, it won't. This will just have been something pending, but not actual, not concrete and final. And that's how the Torah blends this almost like the mixed situation here of yes and no, virtual and actual, into the word v'nikaper, because it now has aspects of virtual and actual. It's got the letters of an if, I mean, it could be this will really be the kapara, but it has the vowelization of the reflexive, meaning it could be that this is not enough. We don't know yet. And that flux situation is what's denoted in this blended word of nifal and hispoil of v'nikaper. That's quite a thing to say. And again, that's something to keep eyes open for as we go throughout Chumash. Words that do not fit absolutely into any given grammatical construct, sometimes they're in the middle because they're harnessing nuances and aspects of two different ideas. But to come back and maybe finish with a general comment, the final pasuk says, "Va'ata tedaver adam hanaki mikirbecha," and you will clear out guilt from innocent blood. Kisaseh hayasha be'enei Hashem. When you do what is right in Hashem's name, what is this a reference to? Actually, Rashi says this is a reference to the follow-up. If you find the killer, you're going to need to then deal with him and do what's right in Hashem's eyes in order to fully expiate the situation. But there is a fascinating explanation of the Ibn Ezra. Again, the final pasuk says, you will get rid of innocently spilt blood. When you do that is right, that which is right in Hashem's eyes. Says Ibn Ezra. He quotes two or three commentaries, which he's not particularly satisfied with. And then he says, V'hanachon be'enai, 1.5 lines. V'hanachon be'enai, what appears to me to be correct explanation of this pasuk, Kilo yishafeich danoki ba'atzecha, im taseh hayosha be'enai Hashem. What is the pasuk saying? The pasuk is saying the first 8 psukim of this section is what to do if such tragedy occurs. But how do you see to that such tragedy does not occur? If you do that which is right in Hashem's eyes, as if to say, if society is functioning as it should, then this sort of thing won't happen. Like as it says, schar aveira aveira, schar mitzvah mitzvah. You do mitzvahs, it will lead to more mitzvahs happening. You do aveiras, more aveiras happening. The chiddush of the Ibn Ezra is that we normally take that on a personal level. A person who does a mitzvah, that will help him to do another mitzvah. But here he's saying, when society does mitzvahs, Ibn Ezra, when society does mitzvahs, it will lead to other mitzvahs happening. If a terrible crime happens, maybe other less terrible crimes have been happening. And they bred this avera. But beyond the mystical level, perhaps we may say, and this is based on the Michtav Melio, sometimes certain crimes happen because there's a climate that allows them to happen. A climate perhaps of understanding, a climate of less than full rejection, and less than full detestation, which allows the person to harbor such an idea, think he can get away with it, or think that he'll be met with understanding. In Sefer Yehoshua, they were told that no one can take any plunder from Jericho, and someone did, the Pasuk, Hashem says to Yehoshua, the Jewish people have sinned, in the plural, and they plundered. In the end, it was only one person, Achan, as we know. So why does the Torah say that the Jewish people sin? So Rav Dessler says, because, of course, the one who pulled the trigger, the one who did the act of plundering, that was Achan. But in a sense, had the Jewish people had developed a climate whereby no one could ever think of such a thing, and he would be an outcast forever, etc., he'll know that no one will meet him with understanding, perhaps that would have given him inhibitions, which means in terms of the climate itself, that is something that belongs to the community. And that's what the final pasuk says, if there is such an outrage about this sort of thing, and such an absolute rejection, perhaps these things would happen. It's a fascinating conclusion to Parshas Mishpatim. It almost closes a circle. Parshas Shoftim begins by appointing judges and almost gives the impression that who takes care of Mishpat? Who is responsible for the judicial system and the criminal system? It's the Sanhedrin. If you've got to go to Sanhedrin, you have nothing else that you need to do. But the Parsha ends by saying that's not so. The community at large, they are the support base. They present the climate, and that determines the type of cases that will end up with a Sanhedrin in the first place. At the end of the day, it's a team effort between the Shoftim and the ones not only who appoint them, but also to support them in terms of the things that they project as being acceptable and unacceptable. We'll leave it over there for you.